We made this.
I'm going to ask MJ to marry me.
A man has to put his wife before himself. Can you do that, Peter?
Yeah, I think I can.
We have some new information. This is your uncle's actual killer. We lost his trail 2 days ago.
This man killed my uncle, and he's still out there.
Everybody needs help sometimes, Peter. Even Spider-Man.
Revenge is like a poison that can take us over. And before you know it, can turn you into something ugly.
The suit. Where'd this come from? The power. Feels good. But you lose yourself to it.
Welcome to Podcast 616 on the We Made This Network, a place where we talk about everything in the Marvel Universe. I'm your host, Dan Owen, and in this episode we're going to be discussing Sam Raimi's trilogy-ending Spider-Man 3 from 2007, in the run-up to the release of Marvel Studios' very own Spider-Man No Way Home. And joining me to discuss all things Spidey are my two guests, both writers and podcasters. First of all, we have Craig McKenzie. Hi, Craig.
Hello. How's it going?
Not bad. And also we have Robert Turnbull.
Hello. Hi there. Hi. Thanks for having me along.
So I know that you've both already been podcasting about the previous two films, but for the benefit of any new listeners coming straight in for number three, which is obviously the most popular of the three, for those few people, I thought it'd be a good idea just to kind of go over very quickly our kind of relationship to Spider-Man as a character, and that kind of thing, and Sam Raimi as a director, and the trilogy as a whole, and all that kind of thing. So, like, just general thoughts about Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3, essentially. So we'll start with Craig. So how old were you when the first Spider-Man came out, and was it, like, a big movie for you? Did it leave a big impression?
So it was in 2002. I was born in 1987. That's math I can't do. I can't...
Was that 15?
Yeah, it's something like that. I don't know. I can't count. I did English at university. I can't count. But, yeah, so I'm the age that Peter Parker's supposed to be in the comics when he starts. Love the character, always have done. Love reading the comics, watching the cartoons, playing video games, all that stuff. I just really latched onto Spider-Man from a young age, and I've never let go. I've always enjoyed it. The Raimi films, the first two, excellent. I love both of them. Remember how excited I was when the first one was coming out and all that good stuff. And the second one was just blew me away. It just knocked my socks off when I saw it. I remember being at the cinema and seeing those action sequences, being like, holy crap, they've done it. They've done it even better than last time. And the hype levels for Spider-Man 3 were off the charts. And we'll discuss how I maybe felt about that as we go.
Sam Raimi is a director. Did you sort of know about him before the Spider-Man films? You know, Evil Dead and all those kind of things?
No, I hadn't seen them. I wasn't really up on a lot of horror stuff at that point. So I'm pretty sure the first Raimi film I would have seen would have been Spider-Man. And then later on, I caught up with his other stuff. And remember when Drag Me to Hell came out, I remember going to see that and loving it as well. Just that's his off-the-wall, ridiculous horror stuff. And then even understated stuff like Oz the Great and the Powerful, which I thought was a good film. I thought it was pretty well done. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I wasn't hugely aware of it. In fact, I wasn't aware of him at all before the first one came out. I don't even think I knew who directors were at that point, except from Steven Spielberg, who was a household name for everybody. But I didn't really pay attention to who was behind the camera at that point in my life. Mm. So I didn't really think about it, I guess.
Okay. So, Robert, what about you? I think you're a little bit older, aren't you, than Craig? So
Yeah, I'm decrepit. I'm an old bastard, me. So, I was 22 when it came out. Like huge Spider-Man fan. You know, Craig and I, we've had a lovely long chat about this. I think we both like the character and admire the character for very similar reasons. Although he's my number four comic book character, but fourth place, you know, especially if you're talking about a top five, are still pretty good. So I was really excited about this film, really looking forward to it. When I say this film, I mean the first film. And then the second film and the third film, I love them all. So the Spider-Man, Raimi Spider-Man trilogy, still very much my Spider-Man movies. In fact, like controversially, I still think that all three of them together, for me, they surpass any of the subsequent Spider-Man movies.
So I think, I'm slightly older than you then. So I'm 23, I was at the time when this came out. So
I thought you were saying you're 23 now.
Yes. That's a deep voice.
When this came out, yeah. I was in the womb watching this. I was a little bit older. So I remember watching the film. I think I was more of a fan of Sam Raimi. So the opposite to Craig, really. I sort of knew about Sam Raimi more than, obviously I knew about Spider-Man, but Sam Raimi was the main attraction. I thought, oh my God, you know, Sam Raimi did the Evil Dead films, and Darkman especially at the time was a favourite of mine. I thought, I can't believe they're giving the horror guy Spider-Man. Yeah. Seemed a bit strange. So especially at the time, I think James Cameron was always the name that you heard in like Empire magazine and stuff. He was always like the rumored choice to be making a Spider-Man film, and they did actually borrow, didn't they, one of his ideas. I think he came up with the idea of the more biological web, so it wasn't like a gadget that he wore. It was actually coming from his own bodily fluid, which is a bit gross, but they did keep that from the James Cameron treatment that went around the internet in the late 90s. I'm that old, I can remember that happening. I enjoyed the first film. I don't think I saw it in the cinema, actually. I saw it on DVD. I don't even know if I saw the second one in the cinema, to be honest. But I did prefer the second one. I think most people prefer the second one. It's just a bit more visually interesting and has a better villain. And I've always liked the third one. And watching this again, I think I kind of like the third one more than I ever did. Every time I watch it, it gets a little bit better. And I'm even tempted to say that there's certain things that I think is better than Spider-Man 2 in this film, I think. So we'll kind of get into that.
I mean, not to leap in, but I'm completely with you there, Dan, because I'm the same. I'm a massive Sam Raimi fan, like huge Sam Raimi fan. So that was a big thing for me. Very exciting that like you say, the horror guy, it's like the Evil Dead guy and Darkman was kind of, I mean, well, there are shots of, well, in the first film, he's just shots from Darkman. And so that was a really big thing for me. Very excited about Sam Raimi. Still love Sam Raimi very, very much. In fact, I did one of my university projects. I had to direct a piece in the style of another director, and I chose Sam Raimi. And got a first, so there you go. Who knows? Maybe I could have done Spider-Man 3. I completely agree with you about Spider-Man 3. I really, really like it. And yeah, watched it a couple of days ago for this. And I like it more every time I watch it. And I think you're right. I think there are elements of it that actually that do improve on the previous films.
I've never disliked it. I've always liked it to some degree, but I do think it's very flawed. It's kind of an interesting failure is the term that gets thrown around. And I do agree with that. It's an interesting film, and it's one of those you can point to, here's where someone interfered, here's where Sam Raimi didn't want to do this, here's where something didn't quite add up. I think it's, you know, there's the bones of something that Sam Raimi wanted to make in there, and then there's all the added stuff that he didn't want to include, and it doesn't mesh together. I mean, I suppose you could argue he did a bad job because he got told to do a job for people that were giving him a lot of money and half-arsed it in some ways, but yeah, that's something we can get into.
So it sounds like we're all quite positive on it, but it's kind of well known as a film that, you know, sank the franchise for a little while there. there was talk of a fourth film, but Sam Raimi had such a terrible time on this one that he never came back to do that, and they moved on and rebooted it twice since then. Yeah, so we're both really positive on the film. I really like how it starts as well, because obviously I haven't seen the second one for a long time now, actually. So, but obviously you can kind of, you know, with the way this starts, you kind of think, oh yeah, I kind of remember now. He's kind of in a really good place because MJ, Kirsten Dunst, knows his secret. So he's kind of very happy being Spider-Man. Everyone loves Spider-Man. He's living his best life, essentially. And he's, you know, even going to propose to MJ. And he has the engagement ring. It all starts on this really kind of positive note. And, you know, even MJ herself, she's got the acting job on Broadway. So she's kind of living her dream. So it starts off in this great place. And I quite enjoyed that, how it starts off on this really, like a high note for all the characters. And then slowly, throughout the course of the film, things start to twist and things get worse and worse. And I really like that. That's one of the reasons I watching this again, I thought, I like that kind of arc for everyone. Everyone has that kind of really high start and it just crumbles, doesn't it?
Nowhere to go but down, yeah.
How about you? You know, the way it starts there, is that something that you appreciated, that kind of the arc of the film?
The start of the film is interesting because it does have that monologue, and I don't know if you've ever seen the YouTube channel How It Should Have Ended. They did a great job sort of lampooning this film, and it's like, why are you narrating everything? And yeah, it's just the, I go to school, top of my class, and I think Tobey Maguire is actually very obnoxious when he's happy in this role. He just, you know, those kind of silly, goofy, childlike grins he has. It's, oh God, can't wait till you're miserable again. This is horrible. Can't deal with this. But yeah, the starting at the high point, and it's almost like Peter Parker's maneuvered into a situation where he isn't aware of just how selfish he's become and how unaware of everything that kind of crumbling around him, because it's not that he quite takes MJ for granted, but he sort of does, and he makes certain assumptions. There's this Harry thing bubbling along in the background that he's not even paying any attention to. He does try to speak to him at the start of the film, but it's not something that seems to be a priority for him. So it's kind of weird that when everything's going right for Peter Parker, he loses sight of what's important in a lot of ways. And it's before the black suit kicks in that everything starts falling apart. So it is his behaviour that causes that and facilitates that.
So how about you, Robert? Do you like the start of the film?
Yeah, I do, actually. I really like it. I like the fact that we're starting on this very positive note where everything is going okay. But the key thing, and it's like what Craig's saying there about, you know, Tobey Maguire seems very obnoxious when he's happy. But I think that's conscious. Because of where we go and what we lead into and everything you're saying about how he does kind of take MJ for granted. Because what we've had two movies, and Craig and I discussed at great length how in the first film, every support character is there just to help Spider-Man become Spider-Man. The first two movies, you know, less so in the second one, but the first two movies focus so much on Peter's story. So actually, when we start in this third one, and Peter is now entirely focused on his story, it's all about him and his story. He's got the girl, he's the hero of the city, he's doing well at university, so he's happy, but he doesn't realize that there are other characters. And it's almost, I don't know whether this is an over generous description, whether it was intentional, but it's almost like the film as a whole is like a meta commentary on how focused the first two films were simply on Peter's story, because all of a sudden you have the other characters kind of come into focus and you go, oh shit, so actually MJ is more than just the damsel. She is not doing so well at her career and she needs Peter to look out for her. So I really like how this starts, because it almost lulls you into a false sense of security. It almost puts you in the same mindset that Peter is in, of like, yeah, everything's great, this is going to be a laugh. And then when you see it fall apart, it's not just the you know, Venom and Sandman come in and sort of kidnap Mary Jane. That's so secondary to it all. It's like it all falls apart because you have to have an adult relationship and Peter doesn't. So I love how it starts. I love it.
Yeah, I particularly like how the first action sequence has really good imagery with like Peter Parker with the engagement ring that he drops mid fight with Harry, and it's kind of like a really good way of sort of symbolizing the struggle that he's got here. You know, this kind of nastier version of Harry comes flying in now as the kind of replacement goblin, and the way he's always kind of trying to catch this engagement ring that's just kind of slipping from his fingers all the time, like his ordinary life, if you like, is kind of slipping away. So I really enjoyed that. I really like that first action sequence. I remember at the time it came in for a bit of criticism because it looked a bit ropey in places, and it still kind of does at times. But nowadays you can just forgive it because you think, well, it's 2007, and you forget that probably even in 2007 they could have done better even then. But you kind of forget that, don't you, as time marches on. So you can, you kind of excuse it.
It's difficult because he's out of costume, so it's very difficult to make it look real. Because you do get your plasticky PS3 cutscene Tobey Maguire face, don't you? And when he's sticking onto the rubble,
that's
falling.
That's
and
just
stuff.
His acting in this. That's all.
True, but the actual sequence has impact, it has emotional resonance, and I always say this about Spider-Man stuff, it's like Spider-Man saving the world and is something that he does sometimes, but it's not very often, and it shouldn't be the norm for him. So him trying to catch an engagement ring while he's fighting someone in the sky is about the right level of stakes for a Spider-Man thing. This is in the Ultimate Comics, but there's a great issue of the Ultimate Comics where he's trying to get out of school so he can go and deal with a situation downtown somewhere. And he keeps getting interrupted as he's trying to escape the school. And by the time he gets there, Iron Man's dealt with it. And it's just this kind of low-key, street-level stuff that Spider-Man gets involved in that I really like. I really like that side of it. So, him trying to catch an engagement ring or make it to an exam or something. Those are the right stakes. Those are... Oh my God, if he doesn't defeat this villain quickly, he will fail his class. That's what Spider-Man worries about. That's what Peter Parker has to deal with, because his future's at stake in a lot of ways. And like you say, his personal life's slipping away at that point, but he wants that engagement ring. That's the goal of that sequence. It's that I can't drop this. I can't lose this.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like it's a more plot-driven extension of the pizza delivery scene in the second movie. It's kind of like a building on that. Which is really nice, because we've kind of seen this sort of almost Peter almost using his powers in a domestic kind of setting. And this is very similar, because it's like he's just a guy who's been out and he's having a fight with his mate and he keeps dropping his ring. And it could just be two guys fighting in front of a bar and the ring keeps almost going down the drain. So it's like, as Craig says, the stakes here are kind of real. You know, Harry's gone evil and is in, you know, tanked up on crazy super soldier drugs and all this kind of stuff, but ultimately it's just two guys having a barney in the street.
And also, I mean, just Sam Raimi just is such a good director, so even if the visuals are not perfect, just his shots that he does, just the energy behind it is always so good. I mean, this whole film, actually, I was always all the way through it, I was thinking, I miss Sam Raimi doing these films, because he just has such the right mentality for it. Every kind of shot composition, even when the way scenes start, it just looks like a comic book panel, and you can just imagine it sort of on the page. You don't get that so much nowadays, do you, with the MCU? They've kind of just become like action comedy films that have got superhero characters in them.
The MCU movies, I think they have some great directors who bring a lot to those films, a lot of the time. But there's nothing as beautiful as a Sam Raimi composition. And you think about Sam, you know, in this movie, you've got the fight in the sewer. That's fantastic. You've got, in the previous movie, you've got the fight on the side of the train. It's like all this kind of stuff that he does. You know, even Goblin and Peter's finale fight sequence in the first movie, there's nothing quite as beautiful and creatively constructed as that in the MCU movies, as great as a lot of them are. And yeah, this sequence, I know what you mean. It's like the special effects in this sequence are a bit ropey. Other points in the movie, the special effects are outstanding and still hold up really well. But even at the time, this one, and I suspect it's the Kroma key. There are some matte lines. That's the real thing that throws it. It's like this, the King Kong problem with the dinosaurs. It's not the quality of the dinosaur animation. It's the quality of the blue screening or green screening. But the sequence is so well constructed and so well directed, and my heart is in my mouth every time he lets go of that ring and it hits that kind of slow motion and the web nearly gets it and all those moments. It's like, God, it's like it's such a such a well constructed, and just like, get the fucking ring, Peter. You don't care about Harry. You don't care about what Harry's trying to do. You don't care about Peter's physical safety. You just care that he doesn't drop that ring.
Especially because it's Aunt May's ring, isn't it? Yeah. It's not just that, it's an heirloom.
The scene, the scene where Aunt May sort of hands over that is such a beautiful, well-delivered little moment of personal character. And it's a lovely little scene. And so it really shores up this action sequence. It gives this action sequence so much momentum and so much meaning.
Craig, you mentioned that the film is flawed, and I think we will all agree that it is. I think the first major flaw that happens, to my mind, is when they go down the route of giving Harry amnesia. As soon as that happened, you're like, oh my God, no, that's just the biggest cliche imaginable, really, isn't it, to do that, to quickly kind of like undo something that you've set up. And it's just so strange that they went down that route. I don't know what else they could have done, really. But as soon as Harry had amnesia and he's in hospital and stuff, and it just, I thought, oh God, this is a bit of a bad decision. Probably the first of maybe two or three bad decisions that the film makes. And I think it's these bad decisions along the way that sticks in people's minds. But I think, like Robert, I'm able to like look past it a little bit more nowadays and just think, okay, it's a bit of a silly choice to do that. But ultimately, it goes somewhere interesting in the end. So that's all good. And the second big flaw that people always mention is the number of villains. So obviously we have what's he called? New Goblin?
Never named on screen, but yeah, officially known, named as New Goblin, yeah.
So you have New Goblin and you have Sandman, and obviously towards the end you have Venom as well, so this is three. Obviously at the time this is a big thing, that everyone's saying there's too many villains, etc. But nowadays you have MCU films with like 30, 40 characters in there, and so yeah. To be honest, it seemed quite quaint having just the three. And like I said, Venom doesn't come in until the last 15 minutes or something. So I didn't mind that even. So this is another reason why I think on a rewatch, nearly 15 years later, I think it's kind of got better, because I don't know, we've just kind of got acclimated to having that many characters on screen. So it doesn't seem such a big deal now that there's quite a few villains in this. And I really like the Sandman villain. So he kind of is the first one introduced, really. He comes of his own kind of problems, because I think another major flaw was retconning the Uncle Ben death and having it be the result of the Sandman character. Do you agree with that, Craig? Is that like an issue for you?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you talk about the three villain thing, and it's true, we've had more villains in more modern films, and I think the key difference is when, say, Spider-Man Homecoming has the Shocker and the Vulture and gangs or whatever, they're not trying to give all of them prominence. There's some that are clearly, yeah, you're just a bit of a stopgap. Whereas here, it's we're trying to do all three of these stories at once, and it doesn't work because there's no time and you can't weave them organically. The Sandman being the killer of Uncle Ben thing really hacked me off at the time, because what it does is it completely undermines Peter's motivation, because the whole thing is he helps people because he feels so guilty, because he could have easily stopped something that led to his uncle's death and he didn't. And he's just trying to settle that scoreboard ever since. But it just seems like, oh no, there was absolutely nothing you could have done. Apparently this was going to happen. I know it's when the partner shows up, the gun accidentally goes off or whatever, but it was someone he didn't even know. It was someone he wasn't aware of. So it does undermine his motivation. I think part of this film is about him redefining his motivation in some ways, even though it doesn't really come across. He's no longer helping people out of guilt. He's helping people because he believes it's the right thing. That's what it's trying to get at, and it's supposed to, him forgiving Sandman is supposed to be that letting go of that guilt, but it doesn't really come across. But yeah, they didn't need to retcon that at all. I think Sandman is a criminal because his daughter's sick is enough.
Is that what you think as well, Robert?
Not quite, because, well, just on the sort of the three villains thing, it's like, I agree with you, like, looking back at it now, it's no biggie. But also at the time, I never quite understood that criticism of their three villains, because we'd had movies with multiple villains, and, you know, Batman had had multiple villains in several movies, and even Superman had had multiple villains and antagonists in movies. So genuinely, even at the time, I was like, I don't get the big problem with there being more than one villain. I know what Craig's getting at about the interweaving of these villains, but I actually think it works, especially watching it again just the other day. I actually think that the stories that they're telling for each villain, I do think it interweaves well, with the slight exception of Venom, which is a whole other thing.
Yeah,
but I think the amnesia thing is a really weird one, because you kind of said how it's weird and it's goofy, but it pays off, and I think that strangely, I think it just about gets away with it. Because in reality, what you actually wanted to do was you wanted to go back and just have Harry not find out at the end of the last movie. That's what you really wanted to happen, which is kind of what they try and do. But I do really like the Harry that comes out of that coma or that accident. I like Harry. I like the fact that he becomes a bit goofy. He basically almost reverts to being a teenager. And actually, the three of them are very happy again. It's like they've sort of got him back and he's lost a lot of his angst. So I really like that. And I like the kind of the narrative that comes out of him having amnesia whilst still it being a sort of an odd thing to happen. But I don't mind a bit of soap opera too much. So I actually think the three villain narrative, I do think it works really well. I think, and I'm sure we'll get onto it more in a bit. I think Eddie Brock I love Eddie Brock in this. I love Topher Grace in this movie. I think Eddie is fantastic. And I also think the Sandman is a brilliant tragic anti-villain. Is that a thing? An anti-villain, like an anti-hero? But this kind of like villainous character. In terms of the retconning Uncle Ben's death, I kind of agree with what Craig is saying because of how it does sort of rob Peter of his initial motivation. But I slightly disagree because I think that it pulls off what it's trying to do a lot better than maybe Craig feels. I think that it does present Peter as now having this confusion over what he has been doing with his life and his motivation. At the end of the movie, it's very much about letting go of that and realizing that he actually couldn't have saved Uncle Ben. It's not his fault. It's not his responsibility. And so now he should be helping people and looking after people almost for the right reason. Because you could argue that a sort of a guilt revenge combo is not quite the right reason. You know, Batman doesn't help people for the right reasons. Superman does. So perhaps this is putting Peter on a better path. I think it works. I think it pulls it off. But again, the sort of the retconning of the death, I think, is very similar to the amnesia thing. It's like it's a weird, goofy plot point, which a couple of redrafts of the script might have got us to that place more effectively. But I think the payoff works for me.
I wonder if there's a fear of introducing a villain that doesn't have a personal connection to Peter Parker in these films, because they did it with Doc Ock and it worked perfectly. And obviously Norman had that connection with him. And then suddenly you're bringing in Sandman, who has no obvious connection. So quick, let's force one. To me, it doesn't really work. But I don't think you needed that, because that's kind of the point in a lot of Spider-Man stories. He's just fighting some low-level criminal that managed to get superpowers. That's it. I mean, I guess for a film, they felt like they needed to do a bit more and have that connection, but you don't.
I think you're right, because I actually think in this movie, Harry's connection to Peter and Eddie's connection to Peter, I think that's enough. And I think the Sandman is more or less so well realized and genuinely really nicely performed that, yeah, you didn't need Sandman to have a connection to Peter. And it maybe doesn't throw me off. It doesn't feel as flat for me as it does for you. But I completely agree that he didn't need to have a connection. His motivation, what he's doing, why he's doing it, that's fine. And he could have done something else within the narrative here that Peter forgives him for at the end. Or Peter forgives Harry and Harry forgives Peter. Obviously, forgiveness is a big part of this story. And I think that is, they're kind of shoehorning the Sandman connection so that Peter has a meaningful moment of forgiveness. And it doesn't need to be there. The film probably would have been tighter without it. And I think that they could have got to that realization. Peter could have had that realization without that connection to Uncle Ben. But it did mean that we got some more Uncle Ben scenes. So that's all good.
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with both of you. It's one of those situations. I kind of see what you're saying, Craig, about you've got three villains here that have all got some degree of prominence. You don't get that so much in later MCU films. But I think, you know, like Sandman's like the main villain, and I think Harry's like a kind of subplot villain, and then you've got kind of Eddie Brock as almost like a kind of simmering away, like a surprise villain at the end. Kind of worked better for me this time watching it. I wasn't upset by it or anything, you know. So it worked for me. I also just have to mention the birth of Sandman scene, going back to another visual effects sequence. But you know, that's a really excellent scene. And you know, it's almost like a little short film of its own, isn't it? This kind of sequence of the kind of sand coming together into like a half human form and trying to kind of grab at that locket and not being able to kind of touch it. And there's the whole way that works. And I think at the time it was really difficult to do that kind of those kind of effects. And it still looks really good today, I think, the Sandman visual effects, especially that scene is definitely a highlight. Just like, it's only like a 3-minute scene, isn't it? But it's just, I felt, really, really kind of touching kind of moment, really.
It has that sort of sense of melancholy and sadness to it. And saying, you know, it's sort of like a 3-minute or so scene, it's actually a long time dedicated to that transformation. You could imagine, you know, even a very nicely made contemporary movie would probably give us that that moment far more quickly, far more kind of like da 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 da. But the fact that the movie takes such a slow, painful, drawn out, and it really helps solidify, no pun intended, it really helps solidify the idea of Sandman's reserve and his kind of like his determination. It's beautiful, isn't it? I think even people that really dislike this movie, I think a lot of them, that's still always one of their highlights.
It's a scene that I remember at the time people used to criticise as well, because they're always saying, oh, you know, it's just so silly that he falls into this particle accelerator and it just happens to turn on. And just people used to criticise for silly things like that, but that's so comic book to me. I could just imagine that happening in the pages of the comic book, and you just wouldn't bat an eyelid, would you, if that happened on page 8 of a comic? No. And you'd be like, oh, yeah, great.
It's basically his origin already in the comics. That's essentially what happens. He just gets blasted near sand, and then he has sand powers for some reason.
We've got that scientist guy, and they're kind of saying, you know, oh, there's a change in the weight, and the scientist, he just goes, ah, it's just a bird, press the button anyway. It's like, what? It's the same as the guy on the Death Star. It's like, nah, there's nobody in that shuttle, leave it. It's like,
it's how it should have ended, pick up on that. It's very much the, how about we go check before we mutate the crap out of something?
Yeah, nah, who cares?
No, I want to get home. Just press the button.
There are so many really dodgy science experiments going on in New York City. It's like constant.
Someone's building a sun. People are mucking about with sand.
Yeah. Just, no one gives a shit. There's no health and safety in New York.
Especially with the crane scene, which was kind of the next big thing that happens, the big crane sequence. So we kind of get Gwen Stacy in this as well. So talking about lots of characters, you also get a few new characters that aren't villains, you know. Gwen Stacy here, played by Bryce Dallas Howard. So you get her and Eddie Brock, as we've previously mentioned. I didn't really pay much attention to Eddie Brock as a character so much, but this time I did. I kind of focused more on him because obviously Venom's now a big cultural thing now with the newer films that are coming out. So I kind of watched this film paying more attention to Eddie Brock. I really liked his kind of introduction because he kind of appears at the bottom of the skyscraper, and he's kind of taking pictures. And it just occurred to me he's just not concerned about Gwen, is he? And Gwen's his girlfriend, so he's kind of he's more bothered about taking the photos.
Read the room, though, Eddie. Yeah, hi, I'm Eddie Brock. I work for the Daily Bugle, and I'm dating your daughter, who is currently dangling for her life off a building. Now's the time to tell you this.
It's like a proper sociopath behaviour, isn't it? And I never quite picked up on that before, and this time I did, and it's strange.
I love him in this film. I think he's great.
So we talked about the kind of new characters a little bit, but obviously going back to the kind of core, returning characters you have here, Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst and everyone. How do you feel that they were in this film? Is this a good movie for them? Did they get plenty to do? I will just mention that Tobey Maguire, I don't know if you agree, but he's a bit kind of divisive. I always find, maybe it's just me that thinks this, because I've got friends, and especially my two brothers, they hate Tobey Maguire. For them, it's always spoiled these films. They just don't like him, and I've always been like, I was always thinking, well, you're wrong. He's okay. And but I know what they're saying. I know what they're saying. He's kind of a bit. I don't know what it is. I've always viewed him as a version of Sam Raimi. Because if you look at Sam Raimi in real life, he's always wearing suits, and he looks very much like Tobey Maguire if he was a little bit more handsome, maybe. I think he'd cast Tobey Maguire because he's kind of like a young, better-looking Sam Raimi. I don't know. I don't know how he's obviously directed to act on screen, but I wouldn't be surprised if Sam Raimi's telling him to play up some of the nerdier stuff maybe Tobey Maguire would want, because he does that little kind of silly dance, doesn't he, along to the marching band, which I always think is a bit kind of cringeworthy. And it's all these little moments where you could easily get rid of these moments, but it kind of Sam Raimi leaves them in. And especially with the new Spider-Man films, I think they've moved away, haven't they? The Amazing Spider-Man ones with Andrew Garfield, he was very much a cooler Peter Parker. And with the Tom Holland ones, he's a bit of a nice mix, I think, in the middle, but I quite like him. But this is definitely Tobey Maguire's, definitely the nerdiest Spider-Man we've ever had. Do you like him in this film?
I think they play up his nerdy side in this one more than they do so in the others. You talk about him doing the stupid little drumming bit, and it's very cringeworthy, but newsflash, he's playing Peter Parker. It's supposed to be cringeworthy. It's the infamous dancing sequence. It's the he wants to be cool because he's more confident because he's wearing the black suit, but he doesn't know what cool is, so he's just doing an approximation of it. He doesn't get it. That's the point. He is as much of a dweeb as he used to be. He just doesn't believe that he is anymore. That's the difference. And these little things like trying to talk to the the waiter in the restaurant and, you know, just being all gleeful and excited. And it's the way he interacts with Mary Jane as well. And I think the two actors do a very good job of portraying this relationship that just is not working. The two of them don't really realize it because MJ doesn't feel comfortable coming to him with stuff that she's upset about. And when she comes to him about the review that was obviously quite scathing, he's just, I don't worry about it. It's just a critic. I'm Spider-Man and I get like criticized all the time for dropping babies or whatever, you know, whatever I fail to do on a daily basis. Mm. And she's just like, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about me. This is, and it's quite a selfish thing on her part as well. They're both flawed and selfish in that way. But I find it really interesting that they're failing to communicate. And they're failing to actually discuss the issues that are clearly existing between them. And black suit or not, the relationship was ending. It definitely was, because it was just heading that way. Mm. There was no way that they were very compatible in that way. But it's interesting. And Kirsten Dunst, Mary Jane, gets much more to do in this film. In the previous film, she's just getting married to some guy and not a lot else. And this film...
Hey, he's an astronaut. Come on.
He is. And yeah, here's the thing. Jameson doesn't seem to be bothered about the fact that this photographer that works for him stole his son's ex-fiance, but never mind, that's an entirely different thing.
He doesn't care. No, he's fair in love and business.
He saved a packet on that wedding that he didn't have to pay for, so we're fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Peter Parker did him a favor as far as he's concerned.
Yeah, he was like, thanks Parker.
Yeah, but I'm still not paying you fairly, so whatever. Yeah, it's interesting now with Mary Jane, her life is falling apart as well. And Peter's insensitive to that, but he's not intentionally insensitive to it. It's just a breakdown communication. I really like that shot where it's after she's been fired and she just walks in the crowd. And you get this wide shot and it's just, she's another face in the crowd, which is not what she wants to be. She wants to be, you know, lauded and stuff. And I love that bit where she comes out of the theater and people are cheering and she's like, oh, thank you. No, you shouldn't have. And then it's because Spider-Man's swinging past. So it's like Peter's upstaging her as well and without meaning to. So yeah, it's a really interesting relationship, actually. And it's a very toxic one, but it's deliberately toxic, I think.
How about you, Robert? Do you like the main characters here? And do they get lots to do?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I agree, you know, a lot with what Craig's saying there. And not to repeat myself for anyone who has listened to the podcast that we did before, but I actually really like Tobey Maguire, and I sort of understand the people that don't like him or didn't like his performance. I would say that they're wrong, but I get it. But I really like his performance. There's something very, what you're saying about, you know, how he's kind of Sam Raimi like and he has that kind of goofiness to him. I think that's very much of the time, because it's like those films, they're representing kind of, you know, it's like, okay, that one, this one's slightly more recently, but they're the best part of like 20 years ago that these films were made. So teenagers and young adults, they were very different and they'd gone through very different experiences, which is why with the current ones, the MCU ones, I think it works perfectly that Peter is actually far less geeky, but also the cool kids are far less cool, and it's all far more of a mishmash, because I think that's what high school and teenagers are like now. Whereas these films back then, I think there was more of a divide, at least, you know, at the point that the first one was made. And so to have this through channel of them, of Peter being kind of like goofy, really works for me. And so I've always liked his performance, and especially in this one, it's kind of what Craig's saying, that he's happy. So actually, even at the beginning, even pre-black suit, he has the confidence of happiness. He's doing really well as Spider-Man. He believes he's doing really well in his relationship, and so it allows him to actually be more open and more free. And yeah, that means he's more goofy, running around, and he's being silly, and he's not paying attention to things, and he's getting swept up in the moment. And yeah, everything in the restaurant with Bruce Campbell is just marvelous. But the scene where he's kind of like, when he sat there and he's like practicing what he's going to say when she sees the ring, it's like, that's brilliant, because that's what a geeky, nerdy, young adult who doesn't really know how romance works would think a romantic moment was going to go, because he's watched movies. That's what he's seen. So I think that he plays it really well. And I think that Kirsten Dunst, likewise, I really, really like Kirsten Dunst. I've always liked Kirsten Dunst. And I really like her in all of these films, but especially in this one, because her story alone in this film is just really compelling and really, really sad. Mm. And I quite like the fact that she's calling Peter on his selfishness, because his selfishness is born out of sort of oblivious nature. He's so happy, he's so joyed up that he's just not seeing anything. And there's something very real and relatable to that, I think, especially when you, if you remember back to your kind of early first relationships, because let's be honest, like, this is his first girlfriend. You know, he wasn't running around with girlfriends during high school. This is his first proper girlfriend, first time he's like properly in love. And so he doesn't know how a relationship's meant to work. MJ, as much as it was sort of plot fodder in the previous movies, MJ's been engaged. She's had a couple of fairly serious boyfriends in the first movie. And of course, she fell in love with Peter and then got spurned. So MJ actually has way more relationship experience than Peter has. And so when she wants that give and take, when she wants to be able to talk to him and he's just giving her platitudes, it's horribly frustrating for her. And it's really, I mean, I you know, I've made certain, okay, I've not quite the same mistakes as Peter Parker. I've never accidentally killed anybody. But, you know, I made similar mistakes when I was in young relationships. And I look at that film, especially looking at it now, and I'm like, Jesus, Peter, you've just got to pay attention. And I don't actually think MJ's that selfish. I think at the time she got a lot of pushback, I think, from fans, like really not liking MJ in this movie, because she wasn't just blindly supporting the superhero. But I love that. And I love the fact that she needs something and she's not getting it. And I love the scene where she says, you know, this isn't about Spider-Man, this is about me. And Peter just can't quite understand that, because he thinks he understands because of his Spider-Man experience. And the whole film, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with the idea that the relationship is definitely due, because I think there are moments throughout this film where they're almost at the point of reconciliation, because they're not assholes, these guys. They're still nice people and they still care about each other and love each other. And I think what they have are kind of very, very real and sort of ordinary kind of like hiccups and misunderstandings and falling outs. But there's always something just to antagonize it beyond themselves. So, you know, Peter's trying to reconcile with MJ and she just needs a bit of a time out. But then he finds out about Sandman and his uncle's real killer. But at that point, when MJ then tries to come and reconcile, he's shut off to it because he's focused on his killer, his uncle's killer. So I think that the antagonists outside, I think they stop them from allowing their relationship to mature. And I think it's at the end of the film where they realize that they have to be mature within their relationship and they have to kind of try and ignore the Spider-Man elements in their life. It'll be fascinating to see what would have happened in a fourth movie.
Well, she does cheat on him, which is a bit weird and out of place. I don't think it needed that. That was a strange addition.
The whole thing with Harry kind of making a move on MJ and all that, I just thought, oh, okay, this is bad. I don't know, it seemed to come out of nowhere a little bit for me, but maybe I'm just misremembering the earlier films where this was it planted as an idea, was it that Harry kind of held a candle for her?
Not really.
I think part of it for me though, it's like, and I'll put my hands up if you want to say this is headcanon, but Harry basically reverts back, you know, he has his amnesia and he really reverts back to the beginning of Spider-Man 1. He doesn't even remember that his father died. So I think the idea that his affection for MJ is suddenly sparked up again, I completely bought that as being in keeping with where he was then emotionally, like he pushed back to that point. So for me, that works entirely. And then of course, when he gets his memory back, it all becomes Machiavellian and he just wants to fuck with Peter's life anyway.
I didn't quite actually see it like that. I didn't really think in the way that he'd been sort of set back to how he was in the first film. I didn't really, for some reason, pick up on that. I just thought he was just being I don't know really. I just thought he was just very strangely making a move on MJ. I was like, oh, okay.
A bit James Franco about the whole thing.
Although it is weird how they set up this whole, oh yeah, the three of us were inseparable, we're best friends. No, you weren't. Certainly not in high school, because Peter couldn't even talk to MJ in high school. We saw that. So when was this point they were like inseparable as friends? In the second film, when Harry was constantly like berating him and saying, hi Peter, happy birthday, who's Spider-Man, tell me who's Spider-Man. I'm sorry, I don't mean to get on you, but who's Spider-Man? You know, that was the relationship in the second film. So I don't understand when this point was that there were, you know, that picture that that Harry looks at before he decides to go help. When would that have been taken in these three films? When was there time for that? When did that relationship exist? I don't think it ever did. I think they just manufactured it for this film, really.
Yeah, I think they sort of, they take a lot for granted in terms of who they were as friends beforehand. They just kind of like, they just want you to go with a little bit, which I do. It's all fine for me. Also, who knows? Harry's like delusional. Maybe he thought that they were much better friends than they used to be.
He actually photoshopped that photo. It never existed. He photoshopped it.
No, Norman made it for him.
That was it, yeah.
He's like, Harry's got no friends. I'm going to get me the Photoshop. Here you go, Harry. These are your friends.
Yeah, I think all the characters, the main characters that are returning, do a good job in this. I think there's plenty for them to do. There's arguably more for them to do in this film than there is in the previous films as well. I think there's plenty here.
There's more screen time to fill, for sure. So, yeah, it makes sense.
2 hours and a half, yeah. There's also a lot going on here with... they've all got like a fear of being replaced. Like, or they even are replaced. Like, MJ's replaced in her play. You got Peter Parker is sort of fearing that he's going to be replaced at the Bugle by Brock as the kind of main photographer of Spider-Man. You've got Gwen kind of replacing MJ as Peter Parker's girl, or she kind of suspects that at one point. And then Harry's kind of replacing Peter Parker as MJ's boyfriend. So there's kind of like this weird kind of situation where every character is like looking over their shoulder at something happening, and there's like a fear that they're going to be replaced, which I didn't ever pick up on before. But
which is quite ironic, really.
It does happen, yeah, a few years later. Moving on then to Venom as a character. So at the time, it was apparently Sam Raimi's intention to have Sandman and Vulture involved, two of the more classic characters that he... really enjoyed as a child reading the comics, and I think there was rumours of John Malkovich being the Vulture from what I remember, which would have been interesting.
It was definitely happening in the fourth one, yeah.
Yeah, oh, in the fourth one, yeah. But apparently in this film, that was the original idea. But he was talked around to instead use Venom by the producers. At the time, he wasn't a big fan of Venom. Venom's quite a newer character from the 90s. And so he didn't really have much of a relationship with that character. Now, it's been said that he actually grew to like the character, so I don't know if that's true or not, but he definitely didn't. initially he didn't like the character. But, you know, I think Venom kind of works quite nicely in this, you know, obviously with the whole black suit thing. I haven't read the comics, so I don't know which version of Venom is more accurate to the comics, because obviously in this version it's just like a kind of gooey kind of black substance that kind of attaches itself to you, and it's like a parasite, and it enhances certain negative emotions in you and things, and kind of gives you a suit of a type. But in the newer kind of Venom films, it's more like another creature, isn't it, that kind of inhabits you and kind of can grow out of you and talk to you, and it's like another character. Do either of you know which one is more accurate?
This one, yeah. This one's more accurate with the costume, because it manipulates you in different ways. It is an entity, and it does get to the point where hosts can commune with it in different ways. So the Venom film isn't completely wrong. Mm. But in terms of how it was first introduced, this is more accurate with it becoming a costume and tempting Peter with greater power and all that stuff. And the disappointing thing about this is when you hear that Sam Raimi is doing a Venom story, you're like, yes, this is it. This is a horror film. This is what you want here. It's Peter being corrupted by this influence that just takes over his life and turns him into something horrible. And then you get Venom you could have had a story where Peter is being stalked by Venom, because in the comics, it was this thing about Venom doesn't trigger his spider sense, knows who he is, knows how to really push his buttons because of that connection that they shared. Peter let the symbiote have access to everything because he didn't know what it was. So there was all that. And I remember there was a lot of rumours at the time that they were setting up Venom for a fourth film. So the film would essentially end, you know, with the scene where he's birthed. Mm. That would be the end of the film. Then the fourth film would be the singular Venom story. And if Sam Raimi was doing that, I want that. I really want that story. So it's a shame that it's so much of an afterthought, because even after he gets the black suit, there's one sequence where he fights Sandman with it, and then he spends the rest of the time sort of dancing about. And you get that, the shades of what could have been when he gives the photographs in at the Bugle, and it's him like juggling motorcycles and stuff like that. It's the Spider-Man's out there and he's being more violent. And I was kind of hoping for a mirror image of the montage in the first film, where everyone in New York's excited that Spider-Man's out there taking care of them and protecting them, and stopping them from being killed by accidents and things. But in this version, it could have been, don't know what he's doing, my kids are scared of him. And you get a bit of that where someone says, like, I don't, you know, but it's more when he's discredited, it's not because of what he's doing. I was really hoping for that montage of scared of Spider-Man New York rather than happy he's around New York, but you don't get it. So it's just such a shame that they could have done this story and they didn't. And now the fact that we're getting unconnected Venom films means that we're probably never going to get this story told properly. And that is really a shame because it's a good story.
What are your thoughts on Venom, Robert?
I fucking hate Venom.
No, well, so tell us what you really think.
So I have...
Don't mince words.
All right then. I really fucking hate Venom. I have very mixed feelings about Venom, especially in this movie. I don't like Venom. I don't like Venom. I don't like that whole McFarlane vibe and style, that very 90s comic book. For me, it was that I never enjoyed Venom. So I was with Sam Raimi on this one. I was not particularly excited about Venom being in this movie. But I also liked the idea that they were going to sort of drop Venom at the end and then they would have a fourth movie that would be about Venom. I was like, fine, okay with that. I feel really bad for the Venom fans because there are lots of them. There are lots of people who love Venom. There are lots of people for whom Venom is their absolute favourite Spider-Man villain. I just, you know, not everybody needs a Moriarty, so I'm kind of like, yeah, okay. But I feel really sorry for those fans because they didn't get what they wanted and what you could argue that maybe they deserved, because it is such an afterthought. And it feels like they got to the end of the movie and some executive said, actually, can we have him in we won't use it for the fourth movie. And we know that there was a lot of studio interference. So I feel bad for people who were Venom fans. I don't like Venom. I'm not interested in Venom, and I don't find Venom interesting at all. So the sort of the quick blast of Venom at the end of this movie, I'm fine with that. I don't mind about that, because I actually feel that this film is not really about, it's not about villains. It's about the relationships, and it's about Peter, and it's about MJ, and it's about Harry and even Eddie. And it's so I find the finale is so secondary to what I enjoy in this movie. But I love Topher Grace, his Eddie Brock. I think it's such a fantastic performance because he is such a wrong'un. Like, there are red flags at every moment, and it's so subtle the way he plays it. I think he's brilliant. He was, I think other than Sam Raimi, he basically was the big comic book fan in this. You know, the other cast, you know, as much as I like them as actors, none of them were really big comic book fans. I think Franco probably had some side-loaded information from his mates who are comic book fans. But Topher Grace was a huge Spider-Man fan and a huge Venom fan. And I think to his credit, he probably put a lot of work into trying to make this character as true for the fans as it could be. But I love Eddie Brock in this movie. I don't care about Venom, so I don't mind that he is just used for the finale. He's used as a weapon in the narrative. But I do kind of feel bad for people that didn't get the Venom that they wanted. And I would have much rather seen a full-on Venom film in a fourth movie. I can be heard reviewing Venom 1 and Venom 2 as part of the We Made This podcast network for podcast 616. Not to give anything away, but bearing in mind how I feel about Venom. But yeah, Craig's right. It's like we're unlikely to get a good version of the Venom Spider-Man narrative, at least for a while, because we're now focused on these weird, not Venom movies. So yeah, it's a shame for the fans, but I don't really care.
I like Topher Grace in this role, and I quite like the idea of he's the douchey Peter Parker, and that draws on the Ultimate version of the character as well. That's what it was more based on than the bodybuilding bitter journalist version. So it's he's a photographer, but he's unpleasant. People don't really like him. It's when he goes in and he's acting all cool around Betty Brant and she is just not impressed. And then he forces his way into Jameson's office and then Peter arrives and Betty's like, you better get in there, Pete, new guy. You know, it's the, okay, you get it. It's Eddie is difficult to like. People don't like him. And people like Peter.
I love all that.
And it's the bit where she speaks to, where he speaks to Gwen. And he's like, oh yeah, what about that amazing time that we had? She's like, what? We had coffee. And I wonder if that's a euphemism. I wonder if they like slept together and he read more into it than she meant him to. And so, because he does this, so I have this girl that I intend to marry. So it seems like they might have had like a fling. And he's planning the wedding now.
I think it was just coffee. I think he's that level of psycho. I think had he not gone off the rails with Peter getting him fired and the symbiote and everything, I think he would have, because he basically does in this movie, stalked Gwen. I think he's dangerous. He's a dangerous sociopath. He's a reflection of the kind of unpleasant, entitled, toxic, but that kind of toxic geek almost. Hmm. And yeah, I think it, I honestly think it was just coffee. I think Gwen is very nice. You know, she doesn't have a lot to do in this, but I think that she is a nice person. She has just enough moments, just enough dialogue to suggest that she is someone who would have let him down very nicely. Probably was browbeaten into going for coffee with him in the first place. And I think he's just a psycho. I think he just is a sociopath.
Yeah, could be right. I don't know. I just got that impression.
I really like the finale of this film as well. It reminded me of Darkman, because it kind of takes place in the same kind of place, isn't it? Like a building site, essentially. So a bit of an echo there to the earlier Raimi film that he did. I really like the finale. It's nothing too different to things we've seen before, I suppose. But I really enjoy it. It would have made more sense with the Vulture being involved, I think, because Harry's obviously there and he's kind of fighting and helping Peter. It would have made more sense to have Vulture as a character, wouldn't it, thinking about it, because they're both kind of aerial characters and fly around and have a fight. But so you can kind of see maybe where the intention was with the finale. But it still works really well. I really think this finale has a lot of emotional highlights. I really like when Harry and Peter make up and they work together to defeat the villains. That's really an emotional moment. And really the best part of the whole thing is Thomas Hayden Church as Sandman asking for Peter's forgiveness and getting it, and that kind of completes the trilogy, doesn't it, really, for me. It kind of like brings everything, you know, that kind of Uncle Ben tragedy that's always been there for Peter has kind of is given some closure. So I think it really works as a way to bring the three films to an end. And I also just like the visual that once Peter's kind of forgiven Sandman, he literally kind of blows away on the wind. It's like a really good visual of like you know your troubles blowing away kind of thing. It's all at peace now. So how do you feel about the finale in general?
I really like the finale. It's one of the early team ups, isn't it, in superhero films? Really, other than X-Men, we hadn't really had that before. So it's notable in that respect. And I know it's an internal universe team up, but it really works. I can do without the news reporter narrating the whole thing. It's hard to believe what's happening. It's like, don't cut to the camera down in the street. I want to see like what's going on. But yeah, it's when Harry's entrance is perfect, I think, when Peter's getting clobbered by Sandman. Mm. I mean, that'd be like hit by a house, wouldn't it? That's what you're thinking about there. And it's where the bomb hits and it's all silent and it takes a few seconds and then it explodes. And then the music swells and Harry appears and you know it's coming, but it's like, yes, that's a great entrance. And it works really well. I like the tiered nature of it. So you've got Sandman on the ground. So if anybody gets near the ground, he'll get involved. And Venom up top. And, you know, it's quite a challenge to juggle all those parts. It gets a bit tropey in terms of the Spider-Man movies, as we're in the third act sequence and it's a fully masked character. So we need to get rid of the mask. So that Tobey Maguire gets some FaceTime. And even Venom just is always removing the face. Stop it. Just give us the face. So again, it's like your actors need screen time and FaceTime, but it's so obvious what they're doing, isn't it? But it's a great sequence. It's really energetic, really well put together and brilliantly done. And I think it might be the first time in the trilogy that Peter defeats a villain by using his intelligence. When he realizes that the sound makes Venom crazy.
Yeah.
And so he reasons with Doc Ock in the second one, doesn't he? And in the first one, he just jumps out of the way in time. So in this one, he's remembering something and he's like, right, cool, this is what I need to do. So this is a good use of Peter's intelligence, which is something they don't use very often in these films, I don't think. So yeah, great finale.
It's maybe my favourite of the three, to be honest. I really enjoyed the finale this time. I thought it was really emotional and had a really good end. So just to kind of get towards the end now of the whole retrospective that we're doing here. So I just wondered if there's any kind of scenes or anything that stood out to you, any particular moments, or a funny moment, just like some of your favourite bits in the film.
So there are lots of scenes in this, and what I want to say is, like, overall, like, generally, I think the film is littered with lots of really, really strong interpersonal moments, which are just beautiful. And some of them are, you know, it's May giving the ring and these kind of things. But there are some scenes which I just adore. And I love the goofy dancing. I love the dancing down the street. I've had so many arguments with people about this. People who are wrong. And Craig touched on this earlier, the point of that, people saying, oh my God, it's so cringy. And it's like, yes, it is cringy. Because Peter is a geek who suddenly has this insane level of confidence. And that's what he thinks makes him cool. Like all those women he's like finger shooting at, they're all looking at him like he's an idiot. And then sort of feeding on after that, the jazz club scene. So genuinely, not just in a kind of trying to redeem the dancing, I love the jazz club scene because that's kind of Peter at his most cruel under the influence of the black suit. Mm. It's very cruel. He's very cruel to two women who both care about him. One cares about him a great deal, and one, I think, cares about him, you know, a fair amount with Gwen. And it's so cruel and it's so callous. And it is, of course, his turning point. And we've also got in that, we see Eddie is he's kind of like stalking Gwen, stalking Peter at that point. So there's a lot going on in that scene. I like how Gwen feels terrible in that scene, and she apologizes to MJ before she runs out. There are lots of little subtle moments in that that I think people miss because they just feel like it's silly and it's goofy. But I would also like to point out that this irritating, cringy, goofy, emo Peter Parker, who everyone is looking at like he's an asshole, the only place that people think he's cool is a New York jazz club. it's the only place where his douchebagness becomes cool.
Except the waitress, she can't keep a straight face. She wants to laugh at him, but she can't because he's a customer.
She wants to kiss him. She thinks he's cool because she's a jazz waitress. But I love that scene. I also really like the when he's on the phone with the cookies, every time he flicks his hair. I think a lot of people really misinterpreted the performance. I think they thought that it's like Shatner with the Khan moment. I think people looked at this movie and they thought, oh, Tobey Maguire is so goofy when he's trying to be cool. It's like, no, Peter Parker is goofy when he's trying to be cool. So there are lots and lots of scenes that I love, and I could sit here for ages, and I've got a whole list that I've written down in front of me. But the ones that I really want to say, the ones that I want to take people who don't like the movie and shake them and say, this is actually good, are those dancing and those singing sequences.
How about you, Craig?
There's a lot of this film I like. I really like the scene where he's getting rid of the symbiote, and you get the really cool image of him sitting on the building in the black suit, just sort of lamenting the fact that he's just punched MJ in the face, which is obviously a very bad thing. He shouldn't do it. And that was the rock bottom moment for him. And then the getting rid of the symbiote. I love the symbiote effect as well. I love the way it moves.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's just... you know, it's so, like, creepy and alien. It's really cool. I really like the comedy. We've touched on the dancing stuff, which I really love. And that montage of Peter just being out of control when he just fully embraces the suit. And it's the J.K. Simmons stuff where, you know, where he's sitting there with his feet up on JJ's desk. And, and he's looking at him confused. He has no idea what's going on. He doesn't know how to react. That's brilliant. Also, earlier in the film where Jameson is clearly on medication for his blood pressure because he shouts all the time, and Betty is just relishing in the fact that she gets to wind him up about it. It's the time for your pill, and it's the, you tell my wife, thank you. And he's just really trying to be calm. And then he yells at Ted Raimi, and then Betty's like, well, remember the anger? And he's like, yeah. And then goes back. And I love that stuff. J.K. Simmons has very little to do in this film, but every second he's on screen is perfect again.
That scene as well, I agree with the pill sequence, because it's a really lovely moment for Elizabeth Banks. And she, weirdly, she gets quite a bit to do in here. I think in very small moments and tiny snippets, I think they really advance her character in the few moments that she's on screen in this film.
Miss Brandt, that's not the position I hired you for. That's what a great line.
And also Bruce Campbell and his cameo. Of course, how could we forget? Cameo was really good as well. Probably the best the best one.
I think it is the best one. It's so pitch perfect. It's like, I am French. It's just superb.
The accidental waves and stuff, and it's like he brings on the and it's like no, and it's like move, Gary. He gets angry at them for coming, even though he summoned them.
Yeah, it's and it beautifully kind of like offsets how serious the scene is, the conversation that MJ's trying to have. But I love Bruce Campbell. As far as I'm concerned, I will have no one say anything against this. He is Mysterio. He's clearly Mysterio. He, you know, in the fourth movie, he was going to be Mysterio. You know, he's playing Mysterio in the comics. He is Mysterio. That's Mysterio messing with Peter. Love it. I think ultimately with this film is that, as you say, it's far more emotional. If you were to take out the superhero-ness of it, if you were to make them all firefighters, or, you know, Harry and Peter are New York cops, if you were just to change that angle but have the same narrative relationships between Harry and MJ and MJ and Peter, I think the film would still be very strong, because it's not about superheroes this time. It's not about the origin of Peter. It's not about Doc Ock. It's not really about Venom. It's about people and their relationships, and even Sandman, it's so much about his relationship with his daughter. That's his motivation. He's not trying to take over the world. He's not trying to gain power. And I think that's the lasting impression, and I think that's what people maybe missed when they watched this first time.
And also there's benefits, isn't it, being the third film. It has the previous two films to help it along, so any kind of rough spots, you've kind of always got that kind of grounding with the characters. It's benefits from being the final part of a trilogy, I think, as well. So just before we go, do you have anything to plug that you do offline or elsewhere, Craig?
Yeah, so as always you can find me on Neil Before Blog, where I review comic booky stuff. At the moment I am reviewing Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow and Batwoman, which are now back. There's a podcast attached to that as well, recently released our Shang-Chi episode, so give that a listen. On We Made This, that can be found on 616, I'm right here. That can be found elsewhere on 616 as well. Also co-host Rarely Going, which is our Star Trek animated podcast, so you can find me there. Personally, on Twitter, you can find me on under Nemesis4909, which, obliged to once again mention, didn't start life as a Star Trek reference. It started life as Resident Evil reference for the third game, and then became a Star Trek reference as well. So there we go. I've fulfilled my legal obligation. I will get my royalties.
How about you, Robert? What are you up to?
Well, again, I'm doing a few of the other podcast 616. As I mentioned, I'm doing a couple about both the Venom movies, so check those out. And Craig and I, if you're listening to these out of order, Craig and I did Spider-Man 1, so why not jump back and listen to that, or listen to it again, because we were very interesting. And I'm also doing the You Have Been Watching British sitcom podcast on the We Made This Network. And my fingers are in a few pies, and I'm popping up in a few other places. Got something fun lined up for Christmas, which we should be launching relatively soon as well. But the best place to find me is on Twitter, and it's Forducks, which is Forducks. And whatever I'm doing, I tend to promote it out there and put links out there, and you can say hello and I'll say hello back. But we shouldn't talk about politics, because I'll get really angry because of the state of the country. And isn't it depressing?
Excellent. For me, I write at the website framerated.co.uk. You can also find me on Twitter at DanOwen79. Thanks for joining us for another episode. And remember, we're part of the We Made This podcast network. So do please subscribe to Podcast 616 and drop us a rating and write a quick review wherever you're listening from. It all helps to support the network. You can also help us financially at patreon.com/WeMadeThis. Where you can get bonus episodes in exchange for a donation. Spider-Man and Marvel isn't all we're discussing at We Made This, so keep listening for a taste of other network podcasts in a moment. And we'll see you next time on Podcast 616.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
The TARDIS crew.
But the 11th hour is just something about the way he comes in immediately and just steals everything away from Tennant. Fish fingers and custard and boom. And yes. Then you get that ending scene where he's walking through the hologram images, and he deserves that at this point.
Absolutely. I think the 11th Doctor is a masterclass introducing the new Doctor. I don't think any story has ever really topped that for introductions.
giddy carousel of pop.
I went to the San Remo Pop Festival on a plane. That's a smash hits memory for you. On a plane with Frankie Goes to Hollywood, we had Frankie, all of Spandau Ballet, all of Duran Duran, Sade, Chaka Khan, Bronski Beat, and Talk Talk, all on the same aircraft. I remember thinking, if this old barge goes down, then A, what's the insurance? And B, you know, the Cocteau Twins will probably have a hit next week because sort of the whole thing will be cleared out.
Right in the childhood.
It's a documentary.
Oh, get in the bin. So this was... Oh, okay, right. We talked about Prejudice, but documentaries, maybe that is the...
So it was a Halloween thing where they had a lot of very famous TV presenters from the time presenting from the most haunted house in Britain. It was massively controversial at the time, and it was... Either you thought it was amazing and, you know, it was critically
like
well
received.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe ish.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.